this is what a lot of people slam object-oriented programming for, is that these programs have just grown and grown and grown. And when you get assigned to that project, maybe you're a junior, maybe you're not, right? You come in, and the first thing a lot of people say when they look at the code of these projects is like, oh my God, this is horrible. How are you guys working like this?
Welcome back to Backend Banter, the show about backend engineers. We talk about, obviously, code and careers on this show. And today we're going to do a little bit of both. I've brought Philip Winston on the show today. If you're not familiar with Philip, he's one of the hosts of Software Engineering Radio, another fantastic coding podcast that I came across a couple months back. And he wrote a really interesting article, I've got it pulled up here, called Brain-Oriented Programming, kind of a paying homage to the idea of object-oriented programming or domain-oriented programming, or all these different kind of programming paradigms. And that's what we're going to talk about primarily today. But before we jump into that, I want to just give you guys a little bit of a background on Philip, because he's got a really interesting career that he's kind of gone through. And I want you to have that context as we talk about the article. So Philip, why don't you take just a second and tell us a little bit about who you are, and then we'll kind of dive into your backstory.
Yeah, I'm a software engineer. I'm coming to you from Virginia, where I've worked at home long before the pandemic.
Before it was cool, yeah.
And so, I graduated from college with a CS degree in 95, and have been working more or less since then in software. My first sort of half was focused on desktop software and graphics, some video games, some simulation, but always kind of one user, one machine setups with no real network component at all. And so I did that for probably 12 years. And then I kind of feathered in and started doing, you know, cloud and cloud backend. My backend is sort of more data pipeline. And I guess, if you just divide it into front end and back end, I would put data pipeline in the back end, obviously. But
yeah,
but you could maybe delineate like back end that's, you know, serving to the client versus back end that's like processing data. My current job, I'm actually doing some back end stuff too.
It's funny that you say that. At my last, well, I should say at the company I had the longest tenure at before boot dev, I was there a little over 3 years. I was in a very similar situation. Like, I was doing ETL pipelines, and we had another team that did like the application backend, like the JSON REST APIs. And like, I didn't really touch that too much. I was just on the data. We kind of, you could make an argument that we were data engineers, but we just called ourselves backend developers. So I don't know.
Yeah, my last job, it was sort of data engineer. It comes up a lot, right? Do you want to divide things into two parts or three parts or four parts? Yeah. So that was kind of my two big areas. There was some, like I said, back and forth in the middle. I did work in neuroscience at a neuroscience research place for a couple of years as a graphics programmer. Maybe that gave me some of these sort of, you know, brain ideas. And I've always kind of like paid attention to neuroscience and psychology and things like that.
Yeah.
As just sort of kind of interesting topics. My most visible thing is I was the lead programmer on Guitar Hero, the first one.
No way.
Yeah,
that's
that was
amazing.
2005.
Yeah.
And I kind of like purposely got into the video games and was there for, you know, 2 years, 2.5 years. And then I moved on to some more simulation, which is kind of like grown up world video games. You know, it's like a very similar technology, but a different set of, different users, obviously, and different set of people working on it. So
that's an amazing claim to fame. I mean, I was there playing it. I think I was a teenager at the time. Loved Guitar Hero. I never liked the knockoffs. and I know this problem, this has like nothing to do with the actual code, which I'm sure was impressive, but the thing for me between Guitar Hero and Rock Band was, the reason I liked Guitar Hero was that the strumming clicker clicked, and my Rock Band guitar did not click. It would just kind of detect once you've moved enough, it would like register a stroke, and that drove me bonkers. The click was like the perfect UX for that game.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what I've seen that recently, like on your phone, sometimes it will, you know, have like a haptic like yeah. sensation like that. And I guess the Quest, those controllers have some kind of but yeah, it's super important to like anchor the time of like, I did this thing and it happened, you know, it's kind of like an acknowledgement that it happened.
Yeah.
But just to throw out one weird thing about that, you mentioned Rock Band. So like, after Guitar Hero took off, there was like this fissioning event, I guess, because Viacom bought Harmonix, which is where I worked, that made Guitar Hero. And then Activision bought Red Octane, which is the company that made the hardware, like the actual guitar and stuff. And so both of them split off. So the code went with, the code went with Rock Band. And the name went with Guitar Hero and Activision. So both of those franchises had the same origin point. And
that's funny. It's like literally the same code base that kind of like.
Well, so Harmonix wrote Guitar Hero, Viacom bought Harmonix, and the code went that way.
Got it. Okay.
And then Activision bought Red Octane. They got the name Guitar Hero. And they rewrote from scratch. In fact, I talked to them briefly. I don't know if I reached out to them or somehow we talked, and they were already pretty far into it. And they asked some questions, and it was like they didn't need my help. I mean, they had just been doing the Tony Hawk series, which is very popular, and they had it under control. I mean, it's not a big game. It's but that was sort of a clone. And I've heard there might be another one coming. You know, they might be working on some revival or reboot. So.
Oh, that'd be interesting. I remember playing Beat Saber on like the Quest, the VR thing recently. And like this, I'm like, this feels like kind of the next iteration of a Guitar Hero type game.
Yeah, Beat Saber is great because it plays to the system's strength, which is like just tracking. And there's no physical way to stop you, right? So the fiction of the game that you have laser that slices effortlessly through, you know, these energy cubes, it works really well. They can implement that. And then I played a game in Quest. It's like you with a broadsword attacking a knight or something. It doesn't work at all because they can't stop your hand. And so, you know, your hand goes like this and then the sword, you know, just... So.
The sci-fi element seems easier to like implement the realism in because like, yeah, you can simulate like the effortlessness a lot better.
Right? And the other one that's great with that is Super Hot. If you ever played that on PC, but the Quest version of that was just spectacular. And again, the fiction of the game is that you can just cut through everyone. They're all made of glass, right? So you can just slice through everyone. But yeah, that was a lot of fun.
No, that makes a lot of sense. That's so cool. I didn't realize that part of your backstory. I'm glad we got to touch on that. It's interesting that like, correct me if I'm wrong, in like the late 90s, early 2000s, I'm guessing the majority of jobs, well, I guess there was the dot-com boom, so maybe it is a little skewed. But I'm wondering, like, were there just a lot more kind of like desktop and like single application type programming jobs than there are today, where it feels like the industry is kind of dominated by web?
Yeah, massively more. I mean, in the 90s, you know, you would go to a store like Egghead. I don't know if that was a national or local, but you know, you go to a chain and it's just boxes and boxes and boxes, and every box contained either, you know, floppies or later CDs and DVDs, but it was all physical media. It all installed locally. It typically didn't even have any kind of network component, right? Because you can have a hybrid. You can have an app that, you know, connects to a backend, like a multiplayer game or something. But yeah, it was like the way I would characterize it is like, back then, if you had a machine that wasn't connected to the internet at all, you could still do a fair amount with it because you had your you know, programs installed locally, and you could use them, right? Whereas today, if you have a machine, a laptop around that you just can't connect to the internet at all, it's just like a boat anchor. It's like, there's not much you can do with it. You can open up Notepad or something.
So I have two employees, full-time employees here at Boot Dev, and they come over and work at my house on Tuesdays and Thursdays. I'm in my basement. You probably can't tell, but this is my basement. I have two employees come over twice a week, and my internet went out the other day, and we literally like couldn't do anything. Like none of our tooling's working. We can't connect to GitHub, right? We can't deploy. I mean, like, I'm sure we could, like, if it were a dire situation, if we knew we were without internet for a long time, we could have got some stuff done. But it was basically like, all right, let's go for a walk.
For a short term, it's actually better to lose electricity than internet, because you have phones and laptops, right? Yeah. They can run for a while. So, yeah, it's pretty bizarre how important that is.
I didn't even think about that. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, cool. Well, you have an amazing background. I want to make sure, though, that we get into this article, because it's really interesting. You sent me this article. It's called Brain-Oriented Programming. You wrote it in August of 2020. I'll make sure to link it down into the description for our listeners. But it really plays with the idea of this 7 ± 2 principle. And it's all about, like, how can we write cleaner code, basically. So can you explain what this 7 ± 2 idea is?
Yeah, I'm blanking on the author's name, but he was maybe Milner or something like that.
George
he was
A.
very
Milner,
famous.
Yeah. Or sorry. Miller, sorry. George A. Miller. Miller. Yeah.
Okay. And yeah, it was in 1956 that it was written. And I went back and read the actual paper, and it's funny how it starts, because it's very conversational and almost jokey. He's like, I've been doing this stuff and this number keeps haunting me. It keeps popping up everywhere. And that's how he introduces it. But basically what he's talking about is like in many different tasks that you try to measure your brain's capacity, you have these very small limits. Now, whether it's 7 ± 2 means, you know, 5 to 9, or I think some of the more recent ones are actually lower, like 4 or 5. But the point is that it's very finite. It's fairly small and it's pretty universal. It's not like, it's not like you can remember 21 things and I can remember 5. It's like, you know, I'm 5 and you're 7 or something. It's, you know, the range is pretty small. And
yeah.
Now the claim of the paper is kind of universal, right? He's kind of saying, hey, this keeps popping up. The actual examples he gives are like discriminating tones of sound. So like, okay, I'm going to play you different tones. If I play you 5 different tones, you can tell me which is which. But if I play you 25, you can't, because they're too similar to each other. And he does light values and things like that. He does mention digits, which is what I focused on.
I wonder if there's any connection to like, I was just going to say, I wonder if there's any connection to like the idea that, I mean, there's what, 7 whole notes? Is it 7? Am I crazy? 7 whole notes in a scale of music, and what, 7 colors in the rainbow? Like, I wonder if these like natural.
Yeah, breaks. I wish I didn't write it down, but that was that. So I said he started a little folksy and he ended folksy also. He actually lists all of those, right? So he's like 7 C's, 7 wonders of the world, 7 this. Seven. And then at the end, he's like, you know, are these related? And he goes, and he basically just says, probably not. So he doesn't, okay, he doesn't make the claim, but. You know, I think there's some relationship, because, yeah, if you're passing things down, especially like verbally, you know, obviously there's a finite capacity. Now we can talk more about long term memory and stuff like that. But when I wrote the article, I did research to make sure that that wasn't just overturned, because a lot of, especially the stuff I learned in college, a lot of social psych studies have just been completely unreproducible. And there's a bunch of interesting theories why that is. But so I definitely checked, kind of sanity check, to see this wasn't just bunk or anything. But more recently, I went back and there were some interesting refinements. And one of them was a theory that your digit span, the number of digits you can recall, if I give you just random digits, 4, mm-hmm. 8, 1, 7, 4, you know, if it's 2 or 3 or 4, it should be super easy. But as it gets up to 7, 8, 9, you're going to you're going to find it's much harder. And but there's a theory that's actually based on, I forgot the exact name for it, but it's like you have 2 seconds of auditory memory. That this is the claim. And so it's really the number of digits you can kind of recite in your head in that loop. And the way they demonstrate this is people that speak Chinese and English had a better digit span in Chinese because of the numbers are shorter or, you know, easier, quicker to pronounce.
Okay. So it's not necessarily that it's like seven numbers. It's like how many numbers you can say in your head in 2 seconds. Is that
in that case? Yeah. In that specific case of the digits, because yeah, you're kind of pronouncing them. And there was another, the generalized term of that was like, there's this thing called chunking, and chunking is how you remember more than seven or more, you know? So an example of that I thought of is like, if you come out of a movie, you know, and I say, can you just tell me the plot of the movie, like The Matrix, right? You're going to be able to tell a pretty detailed recounting of, well, it started out and he was this, and then they came up and they, you know, then there's interrogated him in the office, and then he went on the ledge, and then, you know.
Yeah.
And obviously that's way more than seven things, but the claim is it's because you've kind of chunked them up. You kind of like,
okay,
you know, oh, this is the first half and the second half, and then this happens.
There's like seven sections to the story, and then within each section you kind of remember maybe seven key points or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I would say there's between, you know, 2 and 7 or 2 and 9 or whatever. Yeah, like it doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to be seven. But so anyway, that's the this idea of chunking is kind of how we make sense of the world and how we are able to, because it's not like if you see a list of 50 things, your brain melts, right? You can look at a list of 50 things and kind of make sense of it. And I guess that relates back to the digits of pi. Maybe we could talk about that was in the article.
Yeah, definitely. So just, I want to kind of recap a little bit. So we're talking about this idea that as humans, psychologically, we kind of have a hard time remembering more than just 5 to 9 things at a time, at least in our short-term memory. And yeah, let's talk about pi, because in the article you talk about this guy, I'm probably going to butcher the name, Lu Chao, who like famously recited 67,000 plus digits of pi. So clearly he remembered way more than seven things. Tell me a little bit about how that relates.
Yeah. So what I would say where the limit comes in is if I throw you seven sort of random pieces of information, whether they're digits or names or colors or whatever, if I just throw them at you right now, you that will come close to saturating, you know, what you can remember. But in terms of, yeah, long-term memory, and in terms of like remembering sequences of things, you know, we can remember much longer. And so the 67,000 digits of pi, I forgot how long it took him to recite. I think it was like 10 hours or 12 hours or something. But the way they do it, and there's other, you know, memory, there's actually like a competition, like a memory Olympics kind of thing. They'll do things like shuffle a deck of cards and then memorize the order of the cards. But the two ways that I, or both ways that I read about for pi are based on stories. So it's based on words. And the one way, it's got a name like pi something, you know, it's a language or a name for a language. And it's pretty simple, which is the number of letters in the word is the digit. So if you have the letter A, that's 1. If you have the, that's 3. If you have, you know. Yeah. And so there's actually like you can download a story that will give you 10,000 digits in that fashion. So if you memorize a story and you can do the conversion in your head, then you've memorized.
That's crazy. But like you still have to memorize a 67,000 word story, like word for word, right?
Yeah. But that the thing about that is that people did that even, you know, thousands of years ago. That's how they, like Gilgamesh and the Odyssey and those stories were verbally passed down. Now, my guess is not everyone in the group could memorize the story. You know, like you probably find the one man or woman who's really, you know, good at that, and they listen for, you know, you could listen for weeks or months or years to get the, you know, to get it down. And so I think a lot of that, like a lot of things in life, sometimes it's like people that do amazing things, they do it because they put an impossible amount of time into doing it. You know, not impossible, but like a tremendous amount of time, more than you would you would imagine. So yeah, I mean, if maybe he spent 3 years memorizing that story, right? Well, every day you spend 3 or 4 hours on it, like you know, it sounds more doable, but certainly still super impressive. And you also have to learn that transformation. Like if I think I might have wrote down the story. Yeah, so this was one called Not Awake, which is in one of these sort of Pi languages. Mm-hmm. Now I fall, a tired suburban in liquid under the trees, drifting alongside forests, simmering red in the twilight over Europe. Now I can't do it in my head to say like what digits those are, but that does seem learnable, like with enough practice where you could say like, yeah, Europe is, you know, what is it? 6 letters and stuff.
Yeah. Certainly and easier actually than remembering just actual digits.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in a few ways, you think about that with his large language models is like thinking about language. Like if you have 10 digits, you just got 10 points, you know, and you're just stepping through these 10 points. If you're able to translate it to words, even though you have this constraint on the number of letters, there's tens of thousands of words, you know, that most people know. And so it's just giving you this much broader palette to come up with something that you can memorize. And the guy, he's been surpassed in the world record. I think it's it's over 100,000 digits, but it's that wasn't like authenticated by the world Guinness Book of World Records. But his was actually different than the number of letters. His was like for the digit one, he had, I think I wrote it down. So the digit one, he had, you know, A, ra, re, ru, re, ro, wo, like a whole bunch of syllables. And they weren't even words. They're just syllables. And then for two, he had a whole bunch of syllables. And for three, he had a whole bunch of syllables. So then when he's putting together a story, because he has so many choices per digit, he can like have more freedom to write words. And also because he's doing syllables, he can pack in more digits, right? So if you had a three-syllable word, that could be three digits. So it's definitely impressive and not easy, but it's not. Well, I guess the punchline I kind of glossed over is, and this was in the post, is like, okay, so what's his digit span, right? So he did this amazing thing. He can memorize 67,000 digits. So it turns out his digit span, if you just give him random digits, is like 8.5 or something. So it's the same as any of
a little better than average, but not
a little better than average. So that was really impressive to me because I just was like, I kind of thought 67,000 digits, he's like a freak of nature. He's like a, you know, LeBron James of memorization. But I think that he's very human and he has a very human brain with the same limits that we have.
Yeah.
And I imagine a lot of what he's done there is practice, you know, in training.
Right.
And
so what I'm kind of hearing is we've got like ways to hack long-term memory. We can memorize crazy amounts of things if we like use systems, but in the moment when we're like scanning a file of code, for example, we have this very short-term memory that has a very limited number of things that we can actually keep in our head. So how does this tie into coding?
Yeah. And I think the analogy of that is like a cache, you know, you have, you know, we have a fairly, you know, this is, it's always a mistake to use analogy of the day for the brain. So like the brain used to be a steampunk, you know, steam system, and then it was this, and now it's a computer. So it's not the best analogy, but yeah, it's kind of like a cache. And the thing is that we can repopulate it so effortlessly that we're not even aware of it. And in the article you asked about coding, but just one more sort of one from the post was a vision. And so the fact is, like, I'm looking at you now, if I just focus on, you know, the bridge of your nose and kind of pay attention, I can't really see you know, your headphones, right? I could see them, but I can't see them very clearly.
Yeah.
And what's happening there is you have a fovea, and it's about the size of a quarter or nickel at arm length. And that's all you see in high res, and everything else is, you know, is lower res. And the reason that doesn't bother us is because, you know, wherever you look, you got high res, right? So if you're looking at the Grand Canyon, you know, you look there, you look there, you look there, everything looks great. You know, but you're kind of integrating it. So that's not memory so much, you know, it's different, but it's a similar idea of like, you know, you have the spotlight, you can put it wherever you want. And
well, it's like why we're not necessarily bothered by this idea that we usually only can have like 5 or 7 things in our head, because we can like swap them out really quickly, right? Is kind of what I'm hearing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's why I went from that to that in the post. Cause I was basically saying like, okay, memory works like this, but why doesn't it bother us? And then here's sort of an analogy, or and I'm sure your vision interacts with your memory too, so it's probably not totally unrelated. But to jump into the software side, like I think the thing I was grappling with was like, why are some software systems and some files and some classes and some methods, like why are they very hard to understand? And a theme that comes up a lot, I think, is like dynamic range, you know? And so like, what's the simplest function you've dealt with and what's the most complicated? Maybe because I've worked so many places, like to me, the simpler ones are, you know, difficulty 1 out of 100, and the complicated ones are, you know, 300 out of 100. Like it's really hard, you know, it can get really hard. We had one at the heart of our software, and it was just like, most of the software is very clean, very nice, you know, but this was like, it's a super complicated, you know, 2000 line function that like, just, it ran everything though. It was like right at the heart. And so I was kind of thinking, how do you articulate this? Like, I mean, bigger is harder. That's like, you know, that's a first attempt, right? Like if it's too big.
Yeah, sounds obvious. Yeah.
So I, you know, when I research this stuff and I'm saying, okay, here's a kind of impossibly small number, how can we look at the code and see where does that number apply, or where are we blowing out that number? And so one thing I looked up before this, the PyLint, which is the linter you use with Python, and it has all these recommendations, and sometimes people hate them, like they're annoying and you turn them off or whatever, but some of them are good. And so I looked, they had a design section, and these were all the sort of flags the warnings that they could raise on your code. There was too many arguments, too many nested blocks, too many Boolean expressions, too many returns, too many attributes, too many branches, too many locals, too many public methods, too many statements. So there was all these, and they have numbers for them. I won't read them all, but like too many statements, it's 50. So they're saying if your function has 50 statements, that's okay. But if it has more than 50, they're going to warn you. So notably, that's not 7, right? So that's 50. They're saying like you can, but too many,
it's like a
arguments, which is
sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In the old days, there was issues with screen and column width and stuff. But too many arguments was 5. Too many nested blocks was 5. Too many Boolean expressions was 5. And then the one my article was on was too many attributes, and that's 7.
Right.
So, and I didn't look that up until now, but that, you know, happens to be that same number.
And when we say attributes, are we talking about, are these like data members in a class?
Yeah, members, fields. I think attributes, members, fields are the main names I see in languages. Basically, if you're doing object-oriented programming, and your class has, pieces of, variables that go with each instance of that object. So not class variables, but like, you know, the typical, you know,
human dot height, right?
Yeah. My class is vehicle, and the instance attribute is number of wheels or something like that. So,
even in non necessarily object oriented programming, like with C or Go, this probably applies pretty directly to like fields in a struct. Just data in a collection.
It definitely does, but I can get into a little of the difference, why it's more diabolical, I think, for objects.
Okay.
But yeah, it definitely does. I mean, if you hand me a struct with 50, you know, values, and they're just all sort of random, there's no pattern to it, no comments, it's just 50 random.
Yeah.
That's going to be pretty hard to understand. Where if it's three, it's, you know, it's definitely a lot easier. So, but where I think it gets worse with object-oriented programming, and this I think I explained in the article, but I'm not sure I really fleshed it out, is that this is the key point, is that like a bloated object, an object with too many instance variables, is itself not object-oriented. So like your program is object-oriented because it contains classes, it contains objects. But let's go look at the biggest object in your program, right? And if it has five, you know, attributes, then that's great, right? But if it has 50 attributes, now we've basically said, like, to understand my program, I have to understand this class. To understand this class, I have to understand these, how these 50 attributes interact with the methods in the class. And the point in the article is that that really comes back to saying that that is just a structured program. It's not object oriented. It's not functional. It's basically in the 70s, you know, they started coming out with like loops, blocks, functions, conditionals, switch statements. Like those were all new in the 70s.
Right.
And they were replacing, you know, basically assembly language. Or like Fortran had, you know, very primitive structure. But you know, you've got this shiny OOP language and you're having fun designing your classes and it all looks good, right? But if over time one of those classes just keeps adding and adding everything, it could be methods,
yeah, yeah.
It could be, it's real, you know, then that class itself is really not object oriented. It's in an object oriented system. And so that's why I think it's worse, you know, for object oriented programs, because, and this is kind of the what I'm talking about, which is like in most languages, you would be very shy about using global variables, and certainly not hundreds right. of global variables, right? That would be, I think everyone knows that's kind of insane, or, you know,
yeah.
it'd be pretty crazy. But within the context of that one object, the attributes are global variables because every method can access every attribute, right? There's no...
Right. If you're concerned about, like, if you run into a bug where this variable is getting set to something I didn't expect, you have to check like 50 different methods now, right?
Yeah, and also it ties into functional programming in the sense of like if you're allowed to mutate those attributes, now that object can be one in one of many, many different states. So
right.
I think in the post I talk about like if you have just five Boolean variables, then that's 2 to the 5 states. So it's 32 states, right? And if
yeah.
you had eight Boolean variables, that's 256 states, which means when you call every one of those methods, it has to work properly in all of those states, right? And sometimes that's not hard. Like, you know, depending on what the variables are, it's clear that it's not harmful. But if you have, you know, Boolean states that affect things, like we in graphics, you often have a node, and it'll have attributes like is visible, but mm-hmm. then someone else comes up with like is frozen, because like in the editor you don't want to move the thing, right? So now you have
yeah.
is visible and is frozen, and then you have like is paged out, right? Because you want to say like it doesn't actually have the data loaded. So now in your method you have something like if visible and not paged out or frozen, you know.
Yeah,
you start writing that, and even what I just said there is maybe manageable, but you know, once you add 5 or 6 or 7, like it does quickly become essentially impossible to, you know, to reason about. And that happens in industry. And I think this is what a lot of people slam object-oriented programming for, is that these programs have just grown and grown and grown. And when you
yeah.
get assigned to that project, maybe you're a junior, maybe you're not, right? You just you come in and the first thing a lot of people say when they look at the code of these projects is like, oh my God, this is horrible. How are you guys you know, working like this?
I want to go back to that because I think that was, I've seen this problem come up so many times, especially in backend development, this idea of multiple Boolean variables. And if you're new to development, it can, I think it's a very non-obvious problem. So you gave a great example of maybe I've got this UI and it can be in several different states. It can be frozen. It can be visible, right? It can be crashed, like all these different things. And I've seen a lot of, especially newer developers, make the mistake of, okay, I'm going to have a Boolean toggle for each one. But what that means is, exactly as you said, in your code now, you have to check every combination of states if you want to account for all of them. You have to, like, what happens if it's frozen but not crashed? What happens if it crashed and it's frozen? Like, maybe those always go together. So my, like, general heuristic is when you're running into this type of problem, avoid Boolean toggles and instead come up with like an enum, right? An enumeration of every possible state. And then you can have like one variable that uses that. So I just wanted to make sure we didn't gloss over that because I think that's actually a really great point for new developers to think about.
Yeah, an enum with explicit states can definitely be simpler. And that's a good technique to consider. The other one that comes from functional programming is like have state, but minimize or have no mutable state. Like there's a big difference there. And it's, I think as an object oriented programmer, it's very hard to imagine how to do that. Like when people talk about there's no mutable state, you're just like, well, there's no program. <It's> like, you know, yeah. How do I do that? And I think sometimes even in functional programming, they will have state somewhere, like they'll have some special state object, but as a matter of course, they don't have it. But think of our class. Now we have a class with 7 or like, let's say 15 attributes, right? It's more than we can reason about, but they're immutable, right? So they were created when it was created, those were all set. And then it, you know, during the lifetime of that object, it doesn't actually change. And yeah, how do you do that? I mean, maybe when you freeze the object, right, you actually create a new object that has different, properties or something, you know, so you can't change an object and freeze it and unfreeze it, but you can make a new object
in its place. Yeah.
Although I have heard, I think it was on your show, someone saying that like GUIs are pretty well suited for object oriented programming. Like it's a pretty good fit. You know, like,
yeah. I think that was Russ Ross, my college professor. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, but the I'm not sure where the post goes from there actually, but I think that I guess the other thing I would say that kind of gets in maybe to the reaction to the post, which was some people when they see like those Pylint restrictions and they say you can only have 7, like you can't check it in, you can't check your code in because CI will fail your code.
Right.
Until you know, that really rubs some people the wrong way. Like, and I mean like really irritates some people. Like when that comes up, they'll just, you know, in Pylint, you can just do like a disable, you know, and like right before the line, you just say disable this test. And then people will put that in code review and someone will be like, hey, you can't, you're not allowed to disable that. You got to fix it. And it's like, it becomes almost like a personal, personal pride kind of thing, or like a personal freedom kind of thing. Like they feel like you shouldn't be able to restrict me. And I'm sympathetic to that. I think the important thing is to have some limit. So like if you feel like 7 is just too strict and you obviously 8's not going to kill you, you know? So maybe you do 12, maybe you do 20, you know, but put in some limit, right? Cause you don't want to have 300 attributes in a class. So I think it's more important to have some limit than to to worry about exactly what that limit is. And the other thing to keep in mind is these things grow. Like software grows, especially if it's successful. You know, if you do a side project and you put it aside, it's not going to grow. But if you have a team of, 10 developers working on something, it's like every month, every year, it gets bigger and bigger. And that's where these problems really, no one sits down and writes a class with 30 attributes just off the top of their head. But like, especially for junior people, it's much easier to get a code review of I'm adding one thing than a code review of like, I've refactored this class into three classes, you know, that's, if you're the sole author, you could do that, but,
getting architectural changes through code review is much harder than just like adding a feature or something.
And there you find that if the team is, you know, well designed or if the team is a gel team and they're, successful, they maybe will have people playing different roles. And so, yeah, maybe someone is only comfortable adding the attribute, but someone else comes in and says, hey, you know what? We really should split this up. And that's kind of, that's the wisdom of someone that's like, they've seen the pain that it can cause and they want to avoid that pain. And so they, and that can be different teams have like a queue, maybe of refactoring tasks that don't really add features, but they just kind of improve things.
I'm trying to take this advice of like, try to keep roughly seven things. let me break it down this way. Where I'm at currently in our discussion is I'm pretty well convinced of this idea that I can really only think about five or six or seven things at a time. And honestly, I feel like I'm worse than the average person in terms of like juggling lots of things in my head. Even though I feel like I'm actually, an experienced developer and I do well, I don't like lack confidence in that area. I do feel like when I sit down and like reading a function for the first time, I have a really hard time parsing things. So I'm very into that idea. What I'm trying now to do is like figure out, okay, so what are some heuristics I can like add into my development workflow to like make use of this idea. There's a famous quote. I wish I could remember who it was from. You might know, where it's like, we don't write code for computers. We write code for humans. And that's what this really comes back to for me is like, I'm trying to write code so that I can remember it in 6 or 7 days when I come back to it. And I can think of like functions I've worked on. Again, I don't really work in OOP too often. I'm usually working in Go. Which has some OOP ideas, but I've worked in functions that are definitely too large and it's hard to think of all of the things that are going on, right? Maybe there's 20 or 25 different local variables to keep in mind. But I've also worked with structs, like we talked about earlier, that actually have like 30 or 40 fields that I didn't have a problem with because I didn't always need to think about all of them all the time. So they're all in that top level. There's like 40 of them. But because maybe like the functions that operated on the struct were smaller and only used like 3 or 4 at a time, like that didn't seem to be a problem, if that makes sense. So I'm trying to like tease apart, where do I care about this number 7? Where do I not?
Yeah, the point about kind of having the code be in good shape for yourself to come back to, I would say that's empathy, and it could be empathy for the next developer, but it can also be empathy for yourself. And I think there's nothing wrong with having both reasons, right? It's like, I want to leave this in good shape in case someone else comes upon it. But yeah, I also want to make sense of it myself. I think the idea of a large struct that's accessed, where the functions only have to access a few members at a time is a good example of what I was saying, where this is particularly a problem with attributes in a class. So, I mean, you could do the same thing with a class, right? You could have 30 attributes and you just sort of comment it and kind of say like, these 20 only impact these two methods or something. I don't know. So you could sort of, you sort of do what you're saying, right? You could sort of indicate that this method only accesses these attributes, but that's pretty, ad hoc and kind of, I think it's kind of messy, I think what you're pointing out with the struct is how, if you veer towards functional programming, how things can get simpler. I think the way I haven't done a lot of functional programming, but my impression is that, in my feeling is it's very possible to write really good code in OOP or functional. there are some people who are very against OOP. They think it's the worst thing ever. I don't think so. But I think that it is probably easier to kind of screw yourself over with OOP. And particularly, again, going back to a team, and some people are more hesitant. They don't have the authority, you know, to refactor as aggressively. I think that can lead to this calcification where things just get worse and worse and worse. And I think that's less likely to happen with functional programming, because I think that it would be more obvious that that was happening. So, yeah, I think I guess one micro point I would make is, like, you're talking about a struct, say, with 30 attributes. One pattern I've seen a lot, which, you know, I always give pause to, is when you have variable names that they themselves have been kind of divided into components. So you have an obvious one to be like speed X, speed Y, and speed Z, you know, my speed in these directions. But just looking at, or, you know, background color R, background color G, background color, you know, when you look at those, on the one hand, it's easier to kind of parse that and see, oh, that's kind of just three things. You know, it doesn't bother you as much, but it's also a really good candidate for having that be a new struct or a new class, right? So it's like
you embed the speed struct in the vehicle struct or whatever.
Or just a velocity vector, like vector, have a vector class. So vectors are sort of a generic container for three floats or three doubles or whatever. So, but that's something, but you can see it in more complicated ways too, where you just look at the attributes, and if you've alphabetized them, you know, you just see these patterns where you're like, oh, these are really tightly related. And that doesn't mean you should automatically, and this is where some of the pushback on the post is, because I was like, I gave an example of that, and I'm like, yeah, let's introduce a small struct here. The refrain you hear from people are like, no, I don't like all these structs. I don't like all these small methods. I want to see everything written out, you know, so I can just read it top to bottom. And a lot of times they're talking about like fixing code, right? I'm going into someone else's code and I have to fix it. And man, it would be a pain to trace down. I don't want to see what in my example, I think I had the span class, right? And they're like, I don't want to look up the span class. I just want to see, you know, start and end and stuff. And I would go all the way back to the Liu Chao and the time spent memorizing, which is like, yeah, if you are trying to fix a bug and you're going into a 1,000 line file you've never seen before, boy, you really would like it just spelled out and just, you know, linearized. Yeah. But if you're going to spend a year working with that or 5 years working with that, you know, you're going to learn what the span class is. You're going to learn what the vector class is.
Yeah. Yeah. This is like the hard problem of encapsulation. This is like all programming is like getting the layer of abstraction in the right place, getting the encapsulation in the right place. And I do actually see, I can definitely think of instances where, like when we talked about this little, you know, we got three fields, they're all like speed X, speed Y, speed Z or whatever. We could nest that in a separate struct. So now when I'm accessing it, it would be, you know, vehicle.speed.x versus vehicle.speedx. I can see both arguments. And one of my reasons for sometimes wanting that speedx as a single variable and listing them all out in the top level of the struct is when I want to see it, I don't have to like jump to a new code file or jump to a new section of the code. So I'm actually thinking right now of like the backend code that's running on boot.dev, and we have the user struct, and it has like 40 fields at this point. I can't keep all of those in my head. It's too large. What we've done is we've actually used, Go has this idea of embedded structs where you can take one struct and it's not nested. So I don't have to do like, you know, user.publicFields. You know, what would be a public field? I guess name, right? But I can actually kind of, in my code, I can keep that in an embedded struct, embed it into the user. And now when I'm using that struct, I can just do user.name, but it gives me a really easy way to kind of organize all the fields. And for example, we have this, like, we have it broken up into like public and private. When we're kind of displaying your user on a page where we don't want to like give away your email address, for example, we can just zero out all the private fields and kind of like one simple command.
So with that model, can you pass one of these embedded, can you pass just a portion and just the embedded portion to a function?
Yeah, exactly. So if I had a function that just cared about the private fields, then I could just do user dot the private field. So like user dot private fields and pass that whole embedded struct. So at least in Go, that's been a useful tool for me that I feel like has worked fairly well.
Yeah, that's super great. I've not done enough Go to have seen that, and I'm not seeing that in other languages that I'm aware of. So that's a really neat feature. And I know Go is a relatively small language. I imagine they don't add features willy nilly, so they must have really felt that was useful. And it sounds useful.
Yeah, it has very, very few features. And I would say that like this idea of scoping things down, probably is not as popular in the Go community as in other places, like, for example, Python and OOP kind of languages, probably because as we talk about like breaking an object down so that you have like more objects with fewer properties, you kind of need hierarchies, which is obviously what OOP languages are really good at doing, right? You're creating hierarchies of objects. I've got a vehicle and subclasses into car and truck or whatever. Go is not object-oriented and doesn't support hierarchies. So a lot of times, really the simplest thing and the only thing you kind of can do is have a really large struct with a lot of fields. So there's like downsides to it as well. But I would say in like the general case, you end up with like harder to understand structs because you have many, many fields. But in the worst case, it's better because tricky hierarchies are, at least for me, really hard to parse cognitively.
I would say two things about that. Like, one, there's the maxim dry, don't repeat yourself. That's sort of like a programming rule of thumb. But the rejoinder to that is like, repetition is better than a bad abstraction. So like, you know, if you don't, and I would say this back to the fields, like if we were to couple, you know, it's hard to come up, but if we were to couple speed X with background color R, you know, that'd make no sense. And that would be making the code worse. You need to come up with a good abstraction. And then the other thing I would say is that like, and this is a thing where experience helps, especially if you have experience in the domain. Like if you have done a lot of graphics, you kind of have a feel of where, you know, where things are going, like where it's going to grow. And so in that case, like having speed X, speed Y, speed Z be a vector, I know for sure it's going to pay off, right? Because I know I'm going to be passing those vectors around, right? So now instead of three, and let's say I need to pass in three vectors, right? That's going from 9 arguments down to 3. And then I'm going to have math, right? So I know I'm going to like multiply 2 vectors. Well, it would be utter insanity to like my multiply routine takes 6 6 arguments,
right? And
like it, you know. So I already know exactly. That. And in the article, I sort of it's like a performance system, and I bring up these two abstractions. One is origin, and one is span. And people are like, that's making things more complicated. And I would say it comes down to like, where's the system going? And if you end up passing spans around, doing math with spans, let me intersect these two spans and it returns a new span, like then the abstraction is carrying its weight. But if you just like, you factor it out and you've gone from, you know, 8 down to 6, but you've introduced this class that you never use anywhere, or struct you never use anywhere else, right? Then I think, in a sense, because you're not using that, that becomes a bad abstraction. Like, I don't need to introduce a whole bunch of abstractions if I'm not going to use them, if I'm not going to benefit from it. And I think the term people say sometimes is like, is that abstraction pulling its weight? You know, is it justified? Is it accomplishing something? You know, so So that would acknowledge the people that are kind of complaining about it and say, yeah, you're right. There is a cost to hierarchy. There is a cost to having more places to look up in the code, but there's also a benefit. And so you have to decide, is it worth it? And so I think in your case, even if you didn't have that embedding, you might say, well, the user is the heart of the entire system. And I don't mind passing it around and I don't need to subset it or whatever. It's like, right. I'm comfortable with this. And if I introduced a bunch of abstractions, like their address, their status or this, or that, you know,
this is the user's contact information.
Yeah.
This is like, the user's billing info. Yeah.
Yeah.
We usually don't need to separate them. So I think it makes sense, at least in this case, to, for the most part, keep it together.
And the thing is, it depends on the context. It depends on the rest of the system. So you may very well want to, you know, separate out the billing, but yeah, if you just sort of separate out stuff for no reason, then I agree, you're not adding value. But if you have the Wayne Gretzky thing, skate to where the puck is going to be, right? If you have kind of a sense that, like, hey, given what we're planning to do with this system in the next year, in the next 3 years, like, I know this class is going to get 10 times bigger or more complex. And you see that if someone does a greenfield project, they're just starting totally from scratch, but they've done similar projects, they will start differently than someone who's never done it before, you know, is not familiar with the domain. And so, and that kind of segues around to frameworks. Like, the point of frameworks is kind of to do that initial design for you to, like, no, you actually want a view to be different from a model and, you know, to basically have that structure. So you don't just start out with, like, a main function. No idea what to do.
It makes some assumptions for you, which are hopefully generally good assumptions, depending on what you're trying to accomplish. I want to give just one more kind of, like, concrete example, because I think this especially helps with, like, you know, a lot of the listeners on this pod are fairly new to backend development. So we talk about these, like, high level concepts that are useful, but we really kind of need to tie it into as many examples as we can. So, for example, on boot dev, we have the idea of a lesson. And a lesson is, like, almost like a slide in a slideshow, but for a programming course. And a lesson has several different types. It could be a code completion lesson. So in a code completion lesson, the student can, like, read the instructions on the left and they write code on the right. And there's, like, a run button and a submit button. And it's got all these different features. But there's a few things that are, like, very similar to all lesson types. Like, for example, on the left-hand side, there are instructions and there is an explanation, right? We've got another lesson type that's a multiple choice question. It's got that exact same on the left-hand side, instructions, explanation, but now on the right-hand side, instead of a coding panel, you've got just a multiple choice question. So the tricky bit is, like, okay, where do we draw the lines for the abstraction of this idea? Do we have, like, one lesson class, assuming we were working in an OOP language, or in Go, it might be a struct with methods on it. But do we have this one class and then subclass it? Where do all the data members live, right? Do we assume that all lessons have instructional text, or maybe some don't? And this is where it gets really hard, because, and it just so happens, there's actually about 7 lesson types on boot dev at the moment. And in my experience with web development, and my guess is these heuristics, like these rules of thumb, will actually change across domains. But in, like, backend web development, I've found that it's generally easier to assume that things are different until you've really convinced yourself that they're the same, and then you can kind of merge them. And it tends to be easier to merge them than to tease them apart, if that makes sense. Because if I had, like, one lesson type with tons of, like, if-else conditionals, and, like, is it a multiple choice versus is it a coding assignment, that gets really messy. It's hard to tease that apart. But I found that it tends to be a little easier, given uncertainty, that I keep them completely separate, even if that means duplicating a bit of code. And then once I'm fully convinced that like two things are identical, that I can, like, I can centralize that logic, if that makes sense. I don't know if that's been your experience.
No, I mean, that's exactly the duplication is better than the wrong abstraction, which is, like, if the generic does it all lesson actually is not a good abstraction, in the sense that it's going to be hard to work with, it's going to be complicated, one a feature you add for one lesson type will, it's harder to add it because it's single, and so you end up with modes or, you know,
yeah.
Like yeah, if it's just not a good that it's okay, yeah, that you have some duplication. And I like your point about merge. I do think in a lot of domains, I think of like split and merge. Like if you're kind of overwhelmed with something, like how do I design this thing or how do I redesign this thing, right? Like break it down and focus on like, is there something here that should be split, you know?
Right.
And then focus on splitting that. And is there something here that should be merged? And that just kind of like makes it easier to focus on one thing. And the opposite is like, oh, I have three of these and should I turn it into seven or nine or, you know, like to sort of jump. And no, if you split, you know, and merge, like you can, and I think it's kind of like, this is a weird way to look at it, but it's kind of like, you know, Google Docs maintains presumably your edit history in some form, right? So yeah. You can like futz around and do whatever you're going to do, but it keeps track of, you know, the actual edit operations you did that changed things in your document.
Removed a sentence.
Yeah.
Added a new word. Yeah.
Yeah. And so you as a developer are producing this, you know, it's in Git history probably, but you're producing this list of changes. And yeah, if you make those changes relatively easy to grok and understand, it's better for you. It's better for the people, you know, reading the history. So that's just like incrementalism is good, you know.
Yeah, code, smaller commits.
Yeah.
This is
and
like...
If you save it up and whether you do it as smaller PRs or not, it's a different question. But like you as a developer, because I don't know if you've ever been in a situation where you start, I haven't had this happen in a while, but you start refactoring or doing like a pretty ambitious change and you just can't get it to work and you end up like, undoing it all.
Yeah.
And that's a really bad place to be, especially if you spend a day or two on it. It's like, oh, I just wasted all that time.
Yeah.
So if you do things that are more attainable, more focused, you know, I think that's good.
I talk with my team about this a lot. So like when you're first learning to code, there's like, I feel like every new coder has this assumption that like, you just got to kind of write the whole system. And then like, when you're done writing it, you'll run it and see if it works. Which is obviously like, even once you've just been in the industry for like 2 weeks, you realize that's a problem and you need to try to write very small testable things. You know, I'll get this function working, make sure it works, move on to the next one. I feel like we've just keep taking that idea further and further and I love it. And to give an example, so like, the next step is like, okay, make sure you're committing fairly often. You want like small commits that are fairly easy to test, et cetera. And then it's like, okay, small PRs, right? A pull request might contain multiple commits, but you still want to keep your pull requests fairly small. I'm a big advocate of CI/CD, right? Continuous integration, continuous deployment. And like we deploy to production on boot dev like 5 to 10 times a day. So it's just like lots of little PRs, adding little things. And I think just getting in that habit is really good. There's exceptions. There are some changes that really do just touch everything and you kind of do just need to rip off the Band-Aid. But I think it's there's fewer of those than there are of the things that you actually can break down fairly easily.
Yeah. I mean, going back to the brain and, you know, using the analogy of the computer to talk about the brain, I think it's very appropriate to draw analogies to different software systems that we all know, we all work with. And I think the one you're kind of alluding to is like disks have sectors, networks have packets, virtual memory has pages, you know, like literally, you know, I can't think of another one. But anyway, there's yeah. Almost everything gets broken down into these bytes. And the reason is like a bolus, a big giant chunk of work is going to blow out. Your system is going to blow out whatever. It's just, you can't do that. You can't say like, I'm going to, accept an arbitrary length network packet. Like it just would, you know, it wouldn't make sense. And so, yeah, I think we can draw, inspiration from that in our own work. Now it is possible to do too fine grain. If you've ever worked at big companies, sometimes they have tasks that are really small, and it's like there's a Jira for it, and then you have to make a PR, and it's like, and you're changing like
when
one
writing
line.
The ticket takes longer than writing the code. To me is like absolute insanity.
and I guess a physical analogy is like bite size, right? Like how you're eating your meal, like what's the right bite size? Well, it's not microscopic, you know, you don't right. want it to take you forever, but you don't want to stuff in too much at once, you know? So you got to pick like a reasonable bite size that like allows you to make progress, but is, you know, sort of interruptible or undoable or just bite size, I guess.
Yeah. Well, this has been awesome, Philip. Thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to link the article Brain-Oriented Programming down in the description for anyone that wants to check it out. Before we quite wrap up, I have two more questions. The first is, talking to newer back-end developers that are just pre-first job, what's your favorite like clean code heuristic? What's your favorite kind of rule of thumb for writing better code?
Yeah, you're going to have to edit this out. I got to think for a second.
Yeah, no worries. I just sprung it on you without. Yeah.
I think one thing I would recommend that I think works for people starting out, but it's like a sense that you have to develop, which is just looking at the code almost from like too far back to read it, you know, just kind of looking at the shape of the code on the screen and recognizing like when I'm working with a system or part of a system that I like to work with, that I understand, what did that look like? Like, what did it just visually look like? And then what does my code look like that I'm adding? and particularly like, you know, there's already code there. I'm adding a function. How does that look just visually compared to the ones that are already there? And just notice that. It's not a rule telling you what to do, but it's just saying like, you know, when I look at code for code review, I'm often like looking at that level where I'm just like, this just doesn't fit. Like, this doesn't make sense. You know, every other method in this class is this long, and you just add one that's five times longer. Like, there must be something, you know, there must be some story here. Like, why did you feel that was necessary? And similar to the limits we're talking about, if you see a function and it just has 14 arguments, it's like, well, why, you know, that doesn't look like, we don't typically do that. So like, is there something about this problem you're tackling that merits that exception, that merits that excess, sort of like a, extreme or eccentric or, you know, whatever, you know, or not. Or so anyway, that I've literally done that when I was younger, just like roll back in the chair and look at the screen.
I love this, because I don't think we've heard this on the podcast yet, but I think it's great advice. It's like, why does your code look so different? When I've onboarded team members to like ongoing projects, and it's really nice. It shows a certain amount of like developer seniority, or maybe developer maturity, or honestly just like skill. I think some people tend to be better at it, but like to enter a project and kind of see how everyone's doing everything and kind of mold into that, at least initially, right? Because it's not that the project's doing everything perfectly, but you can kind of figure out why it's written a certain way. And so initially you want to be like consistent with that, right? Consistent with the existing styling. And I think that goes a long way. A lot of junior developers will enter a code base, and you can tell they wrote all of this because it's all different and it's all weird. I love that.
Yeah, I like the point about kind of emulate it a little bit first and then think about, because yeah, you do, especially starting out. Like, I think I had that problem, you know, when I started, you think, you know, you may like overvalue your own instincts or whatever. And, you know, you think you know what's what. And a lot of times there's reasons for the way things are. And so,
yeah,
if you're like, why don't you just do this? Why don't you just do that? Why don't you use this library? It's like, it could be really annoying, you know, to the current team to hear that, especially the first, you know, couple of weeks. But yeah, if you've shown that you can sort of follow the pattern a little bit, and then you can start asking, you know, I would start by asking questions, not by telling them that it's wrong, but just be like, oh, why is it that you guys, you know, I worked somewhere that did it like this. Why do you guys do it like that? And they'll almost always have some answer, but then, you know, maybe that'll get the wheels turning, and then you ask it again, and, you know, eventually yeah. It's like, yeah, we should do it this other way. But
sometimes the answer is as simple as like, we had to ship that feature in one day, and so we just did it, and we can fix it. We just need some time.
Yeah, that's actually one of my ideas for a IDE feature would be like, it's stored in the Git repository, but like, just like color code the code. So it's like, this is the gold code, and like, this is the brown code. Like,
this is what we're proud of. This yeah, is what we're not proud of. Yeah, yeah. I love that.
Because, you know, that's a lot of, you're right, though. You say, like, why is this like this? It's like, oh, well, Joe wrote that 3 years ago, and we, you know, we don't have time to fix it because we got other things we're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think real shipping production systems do tend to have a range of code qualities, because it doesn't actually make sense to like iterate and iterate on stuff that's already doing its job. It's not causing bugs. No one, you know, it's not bothering anyone. Like, if it's a pet project, a personal project, and you just want everything to be gleaming, you know, yeah, shiny, but in the real world, typically like you're working on new features and you're shoring up stuff, but you're not just rewriting things for fun.
Yeah, good. This is an assumption that maybe some new engineers make it, and maybe some don't, but like, code quality does not directly correlate to revenue in a business. Code quality helps. Like, it's not bad, right? And like, certainly lots of technical debt can eventually turn into a big problem for the bottom line. But I do think sometimes we assume that our job is just to write super pristine code when we're just getting started in this industry, when in reality it's to be effective. And sometimes that takes different definitions. Where can people find you if they're interested in other writing that you've done? I know you do a lot of podcasting. I want you to go ahead and just like, just share the places that people can find you and your stuff.
Yeah, I guess I would post anything on my Twitter at PB Winston. I don't do a ton on Twitter, but that's where I would post. I have a blog that's different from the one we were talking about, a different site called metastable.org, which is been a lot about AI recently. It's not a software blog, but it's some of the posts have touched on software. So yeah, I would say Twitter and then this post was on a site called Tobiva, which I set up during the pandemic. I did some contracting and thought maybe I would expand that, but so far I've kind of gone back to full time, but I keep the site up because, you know, you never know. So
very cool. Awesome. I will drop all those links down in the description below. Thank you so much, Philip.
Thanks. It was a lot of fun.